Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know that thing where politicians talk about everything except what voters want them to talk about? Yeah, that. Welcome to the economyless election of 2014 from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 4th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. It's right there, Title 2 of the U.S. Code, Section 7. This is a quote. The Tuesday next after the first Monday in November in every even-numbered year is established as the day for the election. The midterms of 2014 are about to be history, which means the fun is just getting started. Marketplace's David Gura is on the politics of the U.S. economy story today. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
You know, this is something, David, that I was talking about with Cardiff and Lee last week on The Wrap, that despite the fact that polls show people are really worried about the economy, it has not been present in this election. Why is that?
You know, we've seen the ads that we usually see where jobs are brought up, maybe one candidate accuses the other candidate of outsourcing, things like that. But this hasn't been a big issue, as you say, and I think that there are two reasons for that. The first is political. I think Democrats have been reluctant to tie themselves to President Obama and to his policies. So that's one. But I think a bigger reason is probably that the economy is doing better. I mean, you look at the metrics, unemployment is down, and that's made it easier, I think, for candidates not to have to talk about the economy and for voters to maybe focus on other things, like foreign policy, that could be social issues. That being said, you know, I think that there are many Americans who are worried about the economy, who do think that the economy is sort of stuck in place. And a reason for that is that, you know, while unemployment has gone down, real income hasn't gone up. And that's something that we all care about.
Right. It's wages there. Yeah,
absolutely.
Talk to me for a second about Wall Street, would you, as a constituency. What do you suppose the financial sector is looking for out of this election?
I think they're looking for what they've been looking for the last few years, and that's kind of normalcy
and
stability,
right?
And predictability. Exactly. Yeah. I was reading this research note that came out today from an investment bank, and it said Republicans want to pass legislation to demonstrate that they can govern and not just grandstand. So that's if they get the majority in the Senate and the House. That being said, I think it's really rare that a lot of governing goes on in a lame duck session here these next few months before the next term starts.
What happens when all the votes are counted, which we should say may not be for a while in the Senate. But let's just go with the polls and say the Senate goes Republican, the Republicans keep the House. That, maybe I'm just spitballing here, seems to me to mean more gridlock in Washington, not that anything more will get done.
Yeah, I talked to a bunch of folks today, and there was not an optimist in the bunch. I mean, everyone I talked to is really pessimistic about this. And depending on what happens tonight, Congress could get even more polarized. And the reason for that is if you look at the states where it's very close, these are centrist Democrats who could lose their seats. And so, you know, that just would widen that gap that you'd have in the Senate. And just look at the agenda, you know, what lawmakers have to deal with when they get back. They've got a budget. They've got this continuing resolution they've got to deal with. There's sequestration, which is probably going to come up again, those automatic budget cuts. And then haunting the halls of the Capitol, you know, the prospect of another government shutdown, another debate over the debt ceiling. So, you know, very much the same issues we've had, again, over these last few years, time and time again. This stuff isn't far off. And you know what also isn't far off is a presidential election. And it kind of reminds me of how you go to buy Halloween candy at the drugstore and there's already Christmas candy out on the shelves. I mean, people are already planning for that. And that really doesn't lend itself to much compromise or legislative accomplishment, I don't think.
Deja vu all over again, courtesy of David Gura in Washington, D.C. today. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Kai.
Traders were a bit off their feed today. Lousy open, long, slow climb to the closing bell. Never did quite get back to break even. On Wall Street, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oil prices fell again today. I'll spare you the daily TikTok and just say that crude is off 28% since the middle of June. Great, obviously, if you're a consumer. Hello, $2 and something a gallon gas. Not so great if you're a driller. There's the obvious way that's true. Your product gets less when you take it to market. But also, it's not great because a lot of companies in the white-hot center of the fracking boom have taken on a fair bit of debt to get there. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong connects the economic dots.
During the boom, drillers that fracked for what's called shale oil spent more money than they brought in, and they made up the gap by borrowing, which was fine when oil sold for a high price. Now it's down, earnings are down, and lenders are fidgety, says economist Ed Herz at Hillhouse Resources in Houston.
Many of the bankers are very, very concerned about their loans to companies that are exclusively into shale formations. These companies may not have the management expertise or the technical expertise to continue production and pay off these loans.
And oil companies can be credit risks. Standard & Poor's rates 3 out of 4 energy firms below investment grade. The question is, how long will low prices last? James Burkhardt is with IHS Energy.
So if oil, let's say, were $80 for the next year or go even lower, cash flow is lower and external finance would be probably lower as well or more expensive.
Now, all oil companies are not the same. Those mostly in fracking are more at risk. Prices could rise. For now, though, fortunes are changing quickly in the oil patch, says Jake Dollarhide. He's with Longbow Asset Management in Tulsa.
Look, having grown up here and seen what's happened in this Oklahoma-Texas area, seen the booms and busts, seen companies go underneath overnight. Most of the time, it was a two-headed monster. Lower commodity prices, high debt.
I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So about those gas prices I was talking about, falling prices at the pump have given consumers some extra pocket money. According to one economist, we tend to blow some of it at Starbucks, which bonus does mean more jobs for baristas. But some of us also run out and buy trucks and SUVs. Automobile sales from the last month show that Chrysler Jeeps and Ram pickup trucks have had a great month. But surely, come on, that's anecdotal, right? We're not really such shallow consumers that we buy gas guzzlers as soon as pump prices drop, are we? Marketplace's Dan Weissman says, sort of yeah, but not really no.
Car buyers are definitely sensitive to gas prices, and we've got a hair trigger. In 2008, when gas prices spiked and the economy tanked, lots of people ditched their gas guzzlers. Jessica Caldwell is an analyst at the car shopping site Edmunds.com.
They traded into something smaller. They didn't like it. They want to go back. And now that gas prices are low, it kind of gives them that push or even that excuse to say, I'm going to have something bigger.
And people do not do the math on what fuel economy costs them. Tom Turrentine from the Energy Efficiency Center at the University of California at Davis interviewed people from 60 households about this. He picked bankers, college professors, people he thought would be good at math.
Nobody knew how much they spent on fuel in a year. If we asked them, how much did you spend last year on gasoline, they kind of looked at us with some puzzle.
There was one exception, a guy who built a spreadsheet to figure out the best car for him. Spreadsheet said, used Honda Civic. But he wanted a new Ford Escape.
So despite making sort of all the rational calculations, he went with his heart.
So whether we never look at the data or maybe just ignore it, are we making dumb financial decisions? For instance, when gas prices go up, people don't just buy more fuel-efficient cars, they pay more for them. So MIT energy economist Christopher Knittel wondered, do consumers overpay for fuel economy when gas prices are high?
What we find is that consumers, more or less, get it right.
Even without a spreadsheet, the average consumer didn't pay so much for a Prius that it canceled out the expected savings. So, yeah, we're a little impulsive, but we're not dumb. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Gas prices are under $3 a gallon in a whole lot of places, maybe even where you are, lucky. So do those gas prices actually change your behavior? What car you want to buy? The road trip you want to take? Tell us on our Facebook page. The economy on the national level is moving right along. GDP is up and unemployment is down again on a national level. That trend, though, does not hold in the South, which over the past couple of years had built up a reputation as a place where there were plenty of jobs. But over the past couple of months, the unemployment rate in the South is up. Gigi Duban revisits that old truism about lies, damned lies, and, yeah, economic statistics.
Here at the Alabama Career Center in Birmingham, just about every computer is full. Dozens of people are scouring the internet for jobs. Carla Gates is hoping to land a hotel housekeeping position. Today, she's dressed in a suit. There were recruiters there this morning.
I've been putting in applications online. I've gone to a couple of job fairs. I mean, I've been everywhere.
She's been out of work for more than a year.
I think I've had 2 job interviews.
Alabama's unemployment rate in September was 6.6%, up from 6.1% in January. Mississippi's was 7.7%. And Georgia's unemployment rate ranks highest in the nation at 7.9%. To understand why unemployment is higher in the South, you need a little bit of backstory. Ken Trosky teaches economics at the University of Kentucky.
The South was growing more rapidly than, say, the North and the Midwest for an extended period of time in terms of overall employment growth.
He says hiring in the South really hit its stride after the early 90s recession, when those states cut the cost of doing business. Cheaper labor, tax breaks for companies. Plus, these states were right-to-work states, and businesses loved that.
You've seen the South do a lot of things that have been beneficial, and what is occurring, I think, are other parts of the country starting to catch on.
States like Michigan and Indiana are coming up with their own business-friendly policies, and the numbers are just starting to even out.
But eventually, yeah, you reach a new competitive equilibrium in which, you know, the prices for producing a car are pretty much the same in, South Carolina or Tennessee or Alabama as they are in Michigan or Wisconsin.
Equilibrium aside, hiring is up in the South. So how can the unemployment rate be on the rise? Aparna Mater is an economist with the American Enterprise Institute. She says it's statistics. A surge in the number of people looking for work, and boom, unemployment numbers go up.
Even though it could signal that, you know, it's a good economy, people are trying to find jobs, they're more hopeful, and suddenly they've entered the labor market again.
Trosky says this happens more in the South because the workforce in the Midwest and the Northeast is, on the whole, older. So a lot of times when workers there leave a job, they're not looking for another. And that drives unemployment numbers down. Plus, Mater says, to really know what's going on, you've got to look at other things like home sales and GDP.
You know, looking at those indicators is a lot more helpful.
And for a few years now in the South, those things have all been on the upswing. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Actually, loads of the things around you probably have bromine-containing chemicals in them as fire retardants.
Elemental business, my friend. Elemental business. But first, let's do the numbers. Another day, really, of a whole lot of nothing on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials up 17 points today, about a 10%, finished at 17,383, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 15 points, about a 3%, closed at 4623. The S&P 500 shed 5 points, nearly 0.3%, ended things at 2012. Down day for some of the companies that make money off that oil drilling we told you about up at the top of the broadcast. Halliburton shares drilled down nearly 5% today, while the oil services firm Schlumberger was off 2.4%. The first report from Alibaba Group as a public company, that's a profit report, by the way, was a good one. Chinese e-commerce firm said revenues last quarter beat expectations. Shares up more than 4% today. Big gainer on this election day, Office Depot. The chain said sales were up after its merger with Office Max. Shares traded up 24%. Sprint rang down 16% today after the third biggest U.S. carrier said it would fire 2,000 people. Sprint also cut its earnings forecast. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Paris to meet with a French foreign minister. Whole Foods releases quarterly earnings. And on November 5th, 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt won a third term in office. He would be elected to a fourth. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Much as it's no fun delivering bad news, I am obliged to tell you that the sliver of privacy you thought you had in this digital world of ours may be even slimmer than you'd thought. I'm speaking here of something called a super cookie, just like regular digital cookies, but creepier, especially if you're with AT&T or Verizon. Those mobile carriers have been taking the internet browsing done by more than 100 million of their customers and making it a bit more trackable. Super cookies could be the future of mobile advertising, a grave threat to personal privacy, or both. Stan Alcorn explains what makes those cookies so super.
Let's start with the old-fashioned non-super cookie. Jacob Hoffman Andrews at the Electronic Frontier Foundation says that's been the standard way to track people online for nearly 20 years.
The metaphor I use when I teach is I say a cookie is like a name tag.
You step into a website and you get a unique identifying name tag or cookie stuck to your shirt or internet browser. If you forget to take it off, even if it's got a fake name or a series of numbers written on it, anybody watching can see where you go next.
But you also have the option to tear off that name tag.
You can delete those cookies on your desktop computer.
On mobile, we don't have the cookie.
Jenny Wise, mobile marketing analyst at Forrester, says this is the reason for Verizon and AT&T's super cookies. They're a way to track users for targeted ads on the growing mobile internet.
That's sort of the holy grail for advertisers, and ad tech is on the case.
But Verizon's super cookie can't be taken off like a name tag, according to security researcher Jonathan Mayer.
One possible analogy that comes to mind here is a license plate.
Hoffman Andrews again.
That's a very good metaphor, but so much of our intellectual and political life takes place on the internet now. It would amount to a license plate for your brain.
Because it's tied to every question you Google and every article you read. But Verizon says those license plates will be changed regularly and that it doesn't offer any better tracking than what's already out there. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The rapidly approaching end of the year means holidays, holiday vacations, and calculations of how much use it or lose it time workers have on the books, because we are all collectively really bad at taking all the time off that we are due. Nova Sappho explains why that is.
When the tech company HubSpot grew to 200 employees about 4 years ago, founder Dharmesh Shah looked at how to implement a vacation policy.
The concept of this 9-to-5 job where you're working Monday through Friday and you take 4 weeks or 6 weeks of vacation doesn't really kind of fit with the way kind of modern people work and live anymore.
So HubSpot decided to try a new type of vacation policy, an unlimited one. So did workers take a month off?
There's a tendency, I think, for people not to take as much as they should have.
Even with the unlimited vacation days, employees were not taking at least 2 weeks off. In fact, American workers left some $52 billion of vacation time unused last year.
The full week vacation has been on a consistent decline really since the late 70s.
Adam Sachs is with the research firm Oxford Economics. He says not only are we not taking all our vacation time, we're also far less likely to take a long vacation. One big reason for that, he says, is employee perception.
That taking all of their time off was, at best, not encouraged by their superiors. That it would not go well for them in terms of their career track.
But HR professionals want workers to take their vacation time. That's according to Evren Essen. She directs survey programs for the Society for Human Resource Management.
They tend to see higher levels of satisfaction and be more productive on the job and perform better.
Essen says it comes down to company culture. If workers see their bosses taking time off, they're more likely to do so themselves. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The recession's been over officially for 5.5 years now, but there are still millions of people in this country looking for work. Getting back into the job market, selling your strengths to a would-be employer, is hard. But it turns out there are workshops to help you figure out how to do that, the basic idea of which involves perfecting your elevator pitch, the short spiel you give to pitch yourself. Here's how it works.
My name is Dawn Hughes, and I do a job club.
Today, we want to polish your statement, whatever it is that you want to say in the 30 to 60 seconds.
The elevator speech helps that applicant be concise.
I am Ryan, and I am a plumber and warehouse technician.
Out of the many skills that they have, which ones are they bringing to help solve problems that an employer might be having? And this is not as easy to do as you might think.
My expertise is in
my expertise.
When people are in a new job search, they're facing an extra sort of headwind, feeling like, wow, what am I going to do? They're really just freaked out about how can I talk about what I bring to the table.
I've hired and coached and trained probably a couple hundred associates over the years, but I don't know what I'm looking for.
We had someone who had lost her job after 30 years and it sounded like enjoyed her job and felt very much at loss.
There's days I wake up and I'm like, I can't believe it's happening. Like, I still think I work there. Like, the crying at least has stopped mostly, but I have down days, you know, just like you guys, I'm sure.
I actually see transformations often within a class. People go out the door feeling more hopeful.
I have an eye for detail, and I'm fiscally responsible, ensuring projects are done on time and within budget.
And they find their next job very quickly, very rapidly, once they're able to start talking about it effectively.
We got everybody. All right.
Dawn Hughes is a job trainer in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Our story was produced by Minnesota Public Radio's Annie Baxter. Our every now and then colleague from the BBC, Justin Rowlett, has a series he has been doing called Elemental Business, How the Chemical Elements Affect the Global Economy. Today, we turn to atomic number 35. The symbol is Br, and its name derives from the Greek word bromos for stench. Justin, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm well. Bromine, I guess. Is it bromine? How do you say it?
Bromine, we'd
bromine.
Say.
All right, we'll go with bromine. So, what is this stuff, and what's it used
along
for?
With tomato? What is bromine?
Let's call the whole thing off. No, I'm just kidding. Bromine. What is it used for?
I mean, bromine's used for all sorts of things, but most importantly, it's used as a fire retardant. And actually, loads of the things around you probably have bromine-containing chemicals in them as fire retardants. It's an incredibly widely used chemical.
It is also quite toxic, right? I mean, it's not good for you at all.
Elemental bromine can be very toxic, yeah. I mean, it would burn you if it got in your skin, and if you inhaled it, it would do terrible damage to your lungs. So it's a very, right. very reactive, aggressive chemical. It's in the same column of the periodic table as chlorine, so that gives you a kind of idea of the mm-hmm. kind of thing we're dealing with here.
Should one desire to go out and look for bromine, where would one go?
Bromine is dissolved in brines, so you're no. looking for a kind of probably a salty lake. The Dead Sea in Israel is the richest source of bromine in the world and where a lot of the bromine is collected. And essentially what they do is they pump the water into great evaporation tanks that they create, and they evaporate off the water, and then they get a concentrated salt solution and they can distill off the bromine from there. So that's where it comes from.
It also is used back in the day when we had leaded gas. It was in the automotive systems.
That's right. I mean, when they first started adding lead to petrol, the problem was the lead built up a deposit in the engine and therefore clogged it up. So what they needed was something that would allow the lead to kind of flow freely through the engine and out into the exhaust. And bromine was added with the lead, with the obvious consequence that it meant that leaded petrol was producing kind of lead vapors that were quite easily taken up by the body.
Yeah.
What they didn't realize was that even in those absolutely minute quantities, it could cause damage. So that is no longer added to the fuel either.
Is it expensive, bromine?
I mean, it depends how much you want of the stuff and what you're using it for. But tiny amounts of bromine were used until very recently in some soft drinks, for example, Fanta and Gatorade. They used something called brominated vegetable oil, BVO, and it was used as an emulsifier to make sure that the colour mixed evenly through the drink. So without the BVO, the drink would kind of separate. So you'd have an orangey top and a whitish bottom of the drink. But there was a big, you know, scare around it created after a BuzzFeed article which listed it as chemicals that are used in America but not elsewhere in the world. And as a result, PepsiCo and Coke and people decided to take BVO out to keep the customers happy.
Bromine, BuzzFeed, the BBC, Justin Rowlett. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, returning to a fundamental tenet of this program, that context is everything. We've spent, that is, interest groups, campaigns, candidates, citizens, we writ large have spent, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, $3.67 billion on the House and Senate midterms this go round. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, that is, the Department of Commerce, says we spent $59.9 billion on beer last year, which is either, depending on how you look at it, an argument to spend more on politics or less on beer. No, wait, just more on politics. All right? Okay. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up about 17 points, a 10%. The NASDAQ gave back 15 points, a 3%. The S&P 500 dropped itself 5 points lower, nearly 0.3%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Welcome Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.